Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast.
Hello, Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast listeners. My name is Robert Farley, and with me today is Amy Fox, who is the author of a wonderful book called Learning to Fight. If you do some exploration in the LGM archives, and I'll also include a link, we have a review of that book from about a year ago, and I strongly suggest you read the review, but then also read the book. So, Amy, we are absolutely delighted to have you with us here today. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you, in these really challenging times. But yeah, I'm doing really well. And thanks for inviting me onto your podcast.
So where are you recording from today?
So I'm recording from my home office in Oxfordshire. So we're currently working from home at the moment. So lots of lesson planning for next year, but a good opportunity to get around to some research that I've not had time to do.
Right, absolutely. I'm recording from Omaha, Nebraska, at my sister and father's house, which is a little bit unusual for me. But so just to get started, can you tell us a little bit, the readership, a little bit about the book? We actually have a pretty multifaceted readership in terms of different historical disciplines. But could you tell them a little bit about Learning to Fight?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, the book itself is essentially about how the British Army learned, changed, and innovated during the course of the First World War. So the book itself is not just focused on the Western Front. It takes a deliberately kind of organizational view of the Army's kind of commitments across various theaters of war during this particular conflict. And I think what I really enjoyed about writing the book was when I was finishing the writing of it, I was working at the Joint Services Command and Staff College here in the UK. And so actually bouncing off ideas about like learning and innovation in modern militaries with, you know, military practitioners was actually really insightful and helpful in helping me kind of cement some of my arguments and ideas.
Cool. And so you also had access. There's a lot of content about the Australian Army in the book as well, and how learning moved back and forth. I forget just off the top of my head. Did you have a lot about the Canadians? And I ask because we do have a substantial Canadian listenership.
So I don't actually. I favoured one Commonwealth country over another. And that was largely because I had quite good connections in Australia. And, you know, the theatres of war that I was looking at, that the Australian contingent had quite a significant presence in not just the Western Front, but Gallipoli, and also in Palestine. So it was more kind of the mass that they had across those theatres that did really kind of influence my decision to have a discrete chapter that looked at how the British Army integrated Australian forces into its broader organizational structure. So I apologize to your Canadian listeners. I have no problem with Canada whatsoever.
It just reminds me, one of my favorite finds ever, this was actually at Kew Gardens, was of a German prisoner of war report that had been translated from the capture of a Canadian flyer. Just the personal description of this flyer that the Germans gave, it was like sort of this Canadian Superman who sort of believed that he was much tougher and much smarter than any of the British flyers, and he'd been fighting on the front for 4 years. And I posted something about that on the blog, and his family members actually tried to track me down because they were very curious. They didn't have access to this particular prisoner of war report, and he ended up having a very interesting later career.
Wow.
So it was fascinating stuff. So I know that sort of the... And this is where your work is sort of particularly interesting. But I think that all historians of the First World War seem to clash with what has become a deeply cemented vision of what organizational politics and organizational learning was like during the war. There seems to be sort of almost a willingness now to sort of admit, okay, well, maybe the Germans learned a little bit in 1918, and that was pretty much it. But your work is sort of just, you know, tears apart that notion with respect to the British Army in particular, and how the British Army was learning throughout the war, was changing throughout the war, and essentially transformed itself over several occasions, like during the war. So, I mean, maybe keeping up that broad narrative in mind, what were some of the mechanisms by which the British Army was really rethinking and reimagining itself during the 4 years of the conflict?
Yeah, so I think you hit on a really important point there, and that is considering the army over the duration of the war rather than perhaps attempting to periodize it in terms of the army was brilliant in 1918 and 14, but it was really rubbish in 1915 and 16. You know, I think we need to understand, you know, it's learning and it's change as a process. And that requires thinking about it in and problematizing it, you know, actually thinking about it as complex, as messy, you know, as riven with friction, because, you know, fundamentally you're dealing with an organization that is made up of people. You know, I think when we talk about military organizations, we see them as like homogenous kind of blocks, but actually there's people with different interests, different agendas. And, you know, that's those collaborations, those connections are where, you know, fantastic, innovative ideas come from. But at the same time, you know, there's competition and there's conflict within, you know, an organization that is, for all intents and purposes, trying to pull in the same direction. You know, I think I it would be wrong of me not to acknowledge, you know, the fantastic academic scholarship that my work really kind of builds on, and I think just takes that a little bit further. And I think, you know, pioneering works by people like Gary Sheffield and my own supervisor, Jonathan Boff, have really, you know, started to tease out those complexities. And I think what my work does is, you know, it deliberately moves away from the tactical level. It moves away from purely battlefield considerations on the Western Front and actually kind of widens the aperture a bit. You know, what happens if we examine learning in Palestine or on the Italian front? What if we consider learning as more than just tactical improvement? You know, what if we think about what's being learned from industry or from allies? And actually adding all of those different you know, inputs, whether they're external or internal, into our understanding of learning, I think we're rewarded with a much more, albeit messy picture, but a slightly more kind of complete one. But I still think there's so much work left to be done in this area. So I'd love for someone to, you know, tell me that I'm wrong, you know, and maybe I'll have a, you know, second edition where I rework some of my arguments and conclusions.
I particularly enjoyed your discussion of how the organization and how different elements of the organization incorporated civilian expertise, right? Sort of bringing what civilians were doing in industry, but also organizationally, right? People who, you know, were already expertise in certain kinds of administration and then were being brought into the army, sort of to bring those administrative talents and capabilities into it, right? I mean, that's sort of learning by incorporation, which can be difficult for military organizations to do in some situations. But like you discuss, like how they did and how they thought about doing it. So I'm particularly interested, and you just mentioned the Allies point. I'm particularly interested in sort of what we know or how we can think about, because obviously the British Army was not alone, right? I mean, it was a complicated organization in of itself, but it was also sort of deeply linked to at least three other complicated organizations, right? The French Army, the German Army in its own way, and then the American Army. And I know your work doesn't necessarily focus on this, but what can we say about the ways in which the British Army was able to impart the lessons that it was learning to the French and then eventually to the Americans? And then also, what can we say about how the Germans and the British were learning from one another, so sort of from fighting one another during the war?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question. And, you know, to be honest, that's a real, it's an area in the scholarship that it would benefit from so much more kind of close work in terms of that comparative study of inter-allied, but also sort of like learning from belligerents as well. You know, the way I see it is, you know, there are different approaches to this kind of learning relationship between allies and belligerents. I think the one constant, particularly from an allied point of view, that runs through the war is that the interpersonal relationships, what I call like the, you know, liberal approach to learning, you know, those kind of often like ephemeral, you know, ad hoc interactions. And we can see aspects of this playing out in, say, the Royal Flying Corps. It looks at the French air power lessons from the Battle of Verdun and it incorporates that into its own planning for the Battle of the Somme in 1916. We see, you know, kind of improvements in creeping barrages, sound ranging, aerial photography. You know, these are all enhanced and benefit from inter-allied learning. I think what's really interesting is historians have traditionally depicted the relationship between allies as being just one of ad hoc, you know, individuals having conversations. But I think as the war goes on, you do get an increased kind of formalization and codification of this relationship. So what I felt was really interesting in my research was finding like the establishment of inter-allied training schools. And you saw this quite a lot on the Italian front. Obviously, when the Americans come in, you then have another kind of allied dynamic in those training schools. In terms of, you know, kind of codified knowledge, you know, for the French and the British are translating French documents and pushing those out. And then that's in place by like mid-1915. So it's quite early on that, you know, tactical documents are being pushed out. But you also have that with captured German documents. And a really great example is the tunneling companies. So, you know, you've got this tunneling war that's happening underneath, you know, no man's land effectively. And when they come across German tunnels or German equipment, this is written about and this is shared in published form between various tunneling companies in the British Army. So you get a lot of these different inputs and methods of learning at play in this relationship. I think what's clear is there's a real challenge here, right? This is not a you know, kind of challenge free, you know, cross pollinization of learning. You know, I think that a lot of the best practices and the lessons are very context specific and they're quite culture specific as well. So you might have something that works in a French context with French military structures, but that just doesn't translate across to the British kind of experience. And you know, you absolutely see the same thing with the Americans, and there's almost like a little power struggle going on there between the British and the French about, you know, the training of the Americans and, you know, who's got the best kind of staff that are working with them. So there's really interesting kind of microcosm there about like culture clashes in a military context for sure.
Did any, how much of that persisted after the war, right? So a lot of this seems to be have been built around, and again, I want to sort of stick just with the Allies point, although, I mean, the belligerents too, right? But how much more work was there done after the war? How much do we know about whether those connections persisted after 1918 into how the armies were thinking about the post-war context?
So that's a great question. Thinking about it in a broader sense to include the pre-war period, you know, there's a lot of the scientific branches of the army. So I'm thinking here of artillery and engineering. You have that kind of pre-war spirit of internationalism that transcends geographical national borders. And you see a lot of those kind of pre-war relationships revisited during the war. So, for example, French and British counterparts in geographical survey, for example, you know, rekindle their relationships during conflict. And, you know, I think you get a kind of carryover into the interwar period in this respect as well. But I think, you know, as with any kind of human relationship, some of this is quite ad hoc. It can be quite stilted at times. And I think this is largely because of the context in which the Allied armies find themselves in at the war's end. And of course, going through the peace negotiations with all of the different national priorities and agendas at stake. You know, I think for the British, in many respects, the First World War is seen within some circles as almost an aberration, as opposed to, you know, the colonial policing that forms a significant part of the army's job and priorities. But I think if we look at a strategic level, you know, there's certain alignment between France and Britain on major security issues. You know, both nations join the League of Nations, for example. So one would expect, I think, you know, a looking across the channel in terms of military lessons learned, but also opportunities for cooperation in the future.
Here's a question that sort of just occurred to me, and I'm sorry that we didn't prep it, but it does sort of speak to our moment. So I just recently read a very good book, and the name escapes me, but it was a book on the United States Army's reaction to the Spanish flu, and how the influenza, essentially just took the Army by complete surprise, really there was not any sense of how to deal with it. And I don't remember reading anything in Learning to Fight about that, but I am kind of curious because, you know, obviously influenza was uneven and it struck different departments of the Army very differently. Did the influenza come up at all in your research and how different parts of the Army were responding to it?
So it's not something that I was really aware of or attuned to when I was carrying out the research for the book itself. It's actually only in the research that I'm doing right now, which is editing the papers of a senior staff officer, you know, editing those during the COVID-19 pandemic, that I've actually become more attuned, I think, to what actually are numerous references to Spanish flu during this period. So, for example, this officer's family is struck down by the Spanish flu in late 1918. You know, he himself catches it on the Western Front in early 1919. And I think when you read correspondence to this officer from friends and former chiefs, you start to see instances and references to flu cropping up in other theatres of war, such as the Palestine Theatre. You know, one of the generals over there is writing about a number of soldiers who've contracted Spanish flu in September 1918. But what's really interesting is that he's actually quite blasé about it. So he notes in this letter how it wasn't particularly serious. Like, some research has pointed to the British Army camp at Etaples in France as being a key site for transmission, as well as barracks at Aldershot. I think what you're seeing here is lots of soldiers together from different parts of the country and then effectively bomb bursting to different parts of the front line, different operational theatres. But what you do see is some of the measures that we hear about now in the news, right? So the importance of hand washing, wearing masks, social distancing, you know, attempting to be put in place. But I think it's incredibly hard to mitigate against something like the Spanish flu in this wartime context with, you know, a number of stresses, a number of different kind of environments that perhaps, you know, lead to increased transmission and virulence of this particular influenza.
We have noticed, a lot of people who study the period, is how little the Spanish flu is mentioned in many sources, as opposed to the way that people are going to think about this pandemic 100 years from now, where there's considerable sourcing, right? But, you know, in the American literary context, the Spanish flu is almost completely absent from discussions of sort of what happens. And we have, you know, lots of American writers writing about this period, and they talk about it very little. So, but I'm fascinated now, especially with military responses.
You've also got to think, like, the British Prime Minister is very seriously ill with the Spanish flu, you know, so it's something that is, that has, you know, almost a national security implication to it. But yeah, I mean, I think it would be fascinating to actually really understand how the military, you know, uses some of its expertise in dealing with the medical side of things to actually see how it mobilizes to deal with this and try and reduce, you know, the amount of infections, if it even does.
Right. Something else that I wanted to, and this goes back to sort of this question of belligerence, and this is a little bit far afield, but it seems to me that some of the most productive work that we're seeing in, you know, some World War II scholarship in particular, is work that sort of approaches a comparative sort of Russian and German at the same time in the same engagements, and how both armies are understanding how particular engagements are happening. And I'm thinking particularly of Alexander Hill's wonderful book on the Red Army, which does this and sort of, you know, gets at a lot of different sort of organizational theory by looking at how the Russians and Germans are explaining things to themselves that are happening. And I think similarly, there's a lot of extremely productive work right now on the war in the Pacific, where we have a much better sense of what the Australians and Japanese and British were thinking of one another, because we can now look at all of those sources together. I'm just, you know, I'm kind of curious in this context, like, do you know, I suppose, do Germans' perceptions of the British and French change over the war in terms of sort of, do they see this learning? Do the Germans see this learning? Or, you know, conversely, do the British see the German army changing over time? And does this affect how the organizations are responding to the problems they're facing?
So I'll largely speak from the British perspective here, but I think that the British are obviously aware of changes and adaptations that are occurring on the other side of the hill, on the other side of the wire. And you see really interesting responses to this that can be quite reactive in nature, in that, you know, methods are quite localized and ad hoc. But I think, you know, as I mentioned before, you do start seeing that kind of more formalized aspect of things. So the British really start paying attention to what the Germans are doing defensively on the Western Front, and they try and rework their own defensive posture and doctrine through that particular lens. So there is obviously a willingness here to try and understand what the enemy is doing and try to adapt. You know, and as I mentioned earlier, you see this with the tunneling companies and the circulation of German technologies and techniques, not just within tunneling companies in the British Army on the Western Front, but this information is also pushed out to Britain's other theatres of war as well. Now, of course, the Germans are doing much the same thing, and I think really this learning relationship between the British and the German forces is where some really great comparative research has been done, and even more needs to be done. So much as Alexander Hill has done with his work on the Second World War, you know, there's something incredibly beneficial and incredibly rich about that comparative work in understanding how organisations change and react, whether that's formally or informally. And I definitely point your readers in the direction of Robert Foley's work in this area, particularly about the different learning styles that the two armies employed during this conflict.
And of course, Jonathan Boff's work on this as well.
Right. So what was my next question? This sort of gets to a methodological question. It seems to me that you use an immense amount of resources, right? There's a lot of stuff that you have available. You use it very effectively. Is there a methodological concern sort of thinking about using the methods that sort of you work through in and the approach that you work through in this book and applying it to some other armies where we just don't have like nearly as much primary source material, right? I mean, did you feel like you sort of had an embarrassment of riches? And so if we looked at even, you know, starting looking at armies in the 19th century, we might run into problems trying to look this deeply into how the institutions are learning?
So, I mean, I have to be honest, you know, I absolutely had an embarrassment of riches, particularly because I was looking at multiple operational theatres. So, you know, I think the source material is absolutely vital. But also, you know, there's aspects of my work where I didn't have the opportunity to interview individuals. I didn't have the opportunity to do that kind of field work, which I think would be incredibly beneficial and almost essential when you're considering learning in armed forces and military organizations today. Now, you know, I don't see any reason why you couldn't, you know, kind of generalize from this networked approach that I've used, because, you know, that was a methodological approach that was, you know, derived from close reading of military innovation studies, of organizational management theory, of imperial history, and it was just tested in, you know, a deep empirical case study. So I think that there is, you know, most certainly opportunity for generalization. But I think, you know, that there are limitations to it. You know, yes, it's probably generalizable for complex bureaucratic organizations, whether that's militaries, whether it's, you know, civil services, large corporations.
Where I think it's probably of less utility, though, is for flatter organisations or holocracies, leaderless organisations. So I'm thinking here of terrorist cells, for example. You know, I'm not sure how useful this approach would be to understanding those particular groupings. And of course, you're right. You know, the source material is really important in helping understand some of the institutional dynamics, but really getting into some of the interpersonal aspects of learning in modern militaries, for example, would require, you know, that field work and conducting interviews in order to really help unpack that.
I mean, finally, I want to drag you back to this frustrating question that will always come up in the comment section of the blog right here. Is there a way, the myth of the hidebound armies of World War I has been utterly shaken among professional historians, right? But it maintains such a grip upon the popular imagination that I despair of it ever being shaken in any kind of meaningful way. Do you see any progress on this in the future, right? Sort of a fundamental rethink of like how we remember the Great War, or are we doomed? Are people who know something about the war doomed ever to be, simply frustrated by the History Channel historians that we find out among us?
So having given public lectures, published throughout the centenary of the First World War, you know, this whole academic versus popular narrative of the conflict is something that I'm acutely aware of. And I think, you know, the experience of the centenary certainly made me interrogate why that standard narrative of futility, incompetence, lions led by donkeys actually persists. And I think there's maybe sort of like three or four reasons for this. You know, the first is that the casualties are significant in so many operations. You know, from a British perspective, you have the Battle of the Somme in 1916, you have Third Ypres or Passchendaele in 1917, but also the operations that are associated with the 1918 Hundred Days, which are successful, they are still some of the most costly. And there's no escaping or shying away from the nature of the casualties. But I do think it's wrong to assume that generals were all, like, across the board willfully slaughtering their soldiers, or that they were all incompetent and stupid. You know, I think what my book tries to show is that, yes, there are a number of generals who are overpromoted. Yes, there are generals whose inexperience is often painfully exposed. But at the same time, they are thinking of different ways to try and fight the war, to try and end the war. There are debates, there are disagreements, and you get a range of different tactics, different operational methods, and of course, you know, those new innovations and forms of knowledge too, relating to chemical warfare and the rudimentary development of armour. I think the second point, and like we're all a little bit guilty of doing this, is the tendency to compare the First World War to the Second World War. And, you know, the Second World War has that clear narrative, right? It has that dramatic start, it has a heroic end, it's fought for, you know, what are, you know, quite clear moral reasons. And there's a big bit here around perception, right? It's perceived as a war of manoeuvre, of massed armoured formations. And despite Second World War historians' efforts to challenge that idea of it being highly dynamic and expose the highly attritional nature of many aspects of the British experience of the war, the fact is when you compare depictions and writings on the Second World War to the First, you know, you start looking at the First World War and all you see is massed infantry walking shoulder to shoulder across no man's land, or generals sitting in their chateau drinking champagne. And I think when we read the First World War back through the lens of the Second, we start seeing a number of these tropes perpetuated and really come to the fore. And what you don't see in that reading is the significant developments in, again, tactics and method, combined arms, innovations in artillery, the use of scientific management principles, etc. You know, and finally, I don't think we should, and I don't think we can, overlook the cultural impact of the war, whether in the form of war poetry, TV shows, films, you know, the film 1917 being a really good example of the latter. Like, I don't think we should see these as antithetical to academic research on the war. So my own interest in the war, for example, is sparked by studying war poetry at school and books like Birdsong, but also, you know, coupled with my own sort of family history in this area. And if I'm being honest, if films like 1917 make people interested in studying the First World War, then I think that's great. It's great for our profession as well. Now, of course, there is a question, though, about whether historians are doing enough, whatever that means, in order to change the popular narrative about the war. Like, I think it's really hard to judge that. So most academic historians will give public lectures, they do media work, they write blog posts. But is that the best way? You know, I'd be interested to hear from your listeners or others, you know, whether there is a best way of actually actively engaging the public in this kind of discourse.
Well, one thing we can do is podcasts, right? And so hopefully this will be helpful. You know, it also occurs to me, I still haven't seen 1917. Just everything happened in all the world, and I just haven't. And it's probably even available streaming, and I have not had the opportunity to see it yet. I guess just on a closing note, I did want to say I read your book alongside Vaclav Smil's Creating the 20th Century, which sort of really made clear how much transformation there was between, I mean, his thesis basically runs that the entire world was fundamentally transformed between 1865 and 1915 in a way that is not evolutionary, but it's quite revolutionary. And sort of what reading that alongside your book made clear to me was that, you know, the people who were going to war in 1914 were going to war in a universe that was fundamentally different than had existed before. And so the job they had was really extraordinarily difficult on all of the sides from a technological point of view. And I think that sort of really brought home to me a lot of the arguments you were making here and sort of ways that you were uncovering this learning that was happening, is that there was something fundamentally different about how armies were learning from 1914 on, and a discontinuity between how they were able to learn before. And so that was a very interesting, from my point of view, intellectual experience.
It's a book I definitely need to read. It sounds fascinating. But you're obviously right. You know, there's a surfeit of information that needs to be processed. And I think this is aided by the advent of the typewriter, which leads to a significant uptick in material. Also makes my job as a historian much easier, so I don't have as many illegible war diaries to read. And I think what's interesting is like in modern militaries today, there's so much talk about big data. You know, how do you go about extracting the appropriate lessons from campaigns? But you know, as with all things, these are not necessarily new concerns. And really, while like technologies of bureaucracy such as the typewriter, you know, leads to increased amounts of information, you know, I think the continuity with previous centuries and with the one that we're currently in is that human aspect, you know, the agendas, the interests, the predilections, and these all impact on lessons and change. And that, you know, as I've mentioned, you know, really lies at the heart of learning to fight.
Well, Amy, thank you so much. I very much appreciate your time.
Yeah, you too. Take care, Robert. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of the Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of the Paranoid Styles catalog anywhere you can find quality music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through the PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again,